According to the latest water quality report, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has submitted to Congress, 18% of the state's waters have been assessed and are listed, or 18% of the state's waters that have been assessed are listed as impaired. Specifically, 45 new water bodies have been added to the list, but cleanup efforts are underway around the state, and the DNR reports that 35 waters have been taken off of the impaired list. So, the question is, where does that leave Western Wisconsin? We'll talk about that and much more relating to water quality today on the West Side with two water quality experts. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning on the West Side, right here on Ideas Network stations 88.3 WHWC Menominee Eau Claire and 88.7 WRFW in River Falls. Joining me in studio are two gentlemen that are expert in the fields of water quality, whether it's surface water or groundwater. First, Kevin Masaryk. We have Kevin Masaryk in the studio from UW-Stevens Point. He is a groundwater education specialist there with the Center for Watershed Science and Education. Kevin Masaryk, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Also in the studio with us today in Eau Claire is Dan Zur. He is a natural resources educator for UW Extension. Dan Zur, welcome back.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Listeners, if you have questions or comments about groundwater in your area, let us know. If you have questions about surface water and if you live near, say, Lake Tainter or Lake Monoman or any river or stream that you see having some issues with algae blooms later in the summer, give us a call with your questions and comments. 1-800-228-5615. Dan Zur, I'll start with you. I noticed that the state has put out its list of impaired waters, and for the person that might not know what that is, what is it and why does it have to be put together and sent off to Congress?
Yeah, well, the Clean Water Act, which came into existence late 60s, early 70s, it's been amended several times since, has a provision in there, Section 303D, if you really want to know. That's why the impaired waters list is sometimes called the 303D list. Basically, the law states that every 2 years, states have to reassess their waters and assess them for water quality to see if they're meeting state and national water quality standards. And those that aren't have to be published on the list, the state impaired waters list. The follow-through on that is that states are supposed to do, for those waters that are impaired, a total maximum daily load is supposed to be done. I use the word supposed to because it often doesn't happen because of budget restrictions and time and just the fact that the list is getting quite long. For many states, it makes it very hard for them to be able to get to all that. But what a total maximum daily load is it's basically just kind of a recipe for that water body. How much of the pollutant that is preventing that water body from meeting water quality standards, how much of that pollutant can that stream or that lake take before it doesn't meet standards? In other words, we're here, you know, we're up at this end now. How do we get down to that point? Where is that point that we need to get down to where we'll get back to meeting water quality standards? So a TMDL will say something like, if it's for phosphorus, it'll say we need to annually remove or keep from going into the stream 8,000 pounds of phosphorus.
Right.
If we can reduce the amount of phosphorus entering that stream or that lake by 8,000 pounds, we should get back to water quality standards. We should get back to where we are. And there are TMDLs for many of the water bodies in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has been focusing a lot on the larger water systems to do TMDLs for. There's one that was just completed for the Wisconsin River that's been underway for quite a few years. One of the first ones that came into existence in this area was for Half Moon Lake. TMDL has been in place for over a decade now, and a lot has been done to work on improving the water quality in Half Moon Lake.
And more recently, the Red Cedar, at least Lake Manoman and Lake Tainter. Was it the whole Red Cedar River watershed?
Originally, that's a big story.
It's a 20-year-long story, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, the Red Cedar TMDL was begun back in the 90s with some research in the 90s. And for one reason or another, it got put on hold. And then it was originally just going to be for Lake Tainter. And then Lake Manoman was added, so that added some more work to coming up with that TMDL, to writing that TMDL. And basically, because Lakes Tainter and Manoman are kind of at the bottom of the Red Cedar watershed, it is pretty much the whole Red Cedar system that is. The TMDL is written for those two lakes. But in order to improve those two lakes, you're going to have to cut back phosphorus loads into that system all the way up to the headwaters. And if you look at the 303D list, as you go upstream, you'll see the Chetek chain of lakes on the Red Cedar is impaired. Rice Lake is impaired.
Sure.
So all of those lakes are involved in that process. And once the TMDL is written in the Clean Water Act, once the TMDL is written, there really isn't anything else in federal law that says, now you have to do this. Mm-hmm. So what has happened since is the EPA and the federal government have made funds available. 319, Section 319 of the Clean Water Act says we will give states a certain amount of money for non-point source pollution control, and that's the Section 319 money that goes to DNR, and DNR hands that out in grants. There's also money coming from the federal government and from the state for more urban applications. When you've got stormwater issues, all the larger communities within a watershed have to have a stormwater permit, mm-hmm. and that stormwater permit basically dictates how the community will manage their stormwater, or put some guidelines. I shouldn't say dictate, put some guidelines on how they manage their stormwater. So both the urban runoff and the rural runoff, the non-point source runoff, is addressed mostly through funding. The point sources, end of pipe things, wastewater treatment plants, industrial facilities, point sources are heavily regulated in the Clean Water Act. You really, if you have any kind of pipe that's going into a stream or into a lake, you have to be testing that water periodically and making sure that it's meeting standards. So whatever you're dumping right out the end of your pipe into that water body is heavily monitored. And so in that regard, we've made a lot of progress in terms of point source pollution reduction because it is so heavily regulated. The non-point source, the runoff stuff from farm fields, from urban areas, not quite as regulated. There's reasons why that didn't make it into the mm-hmm. Clean Water Act. There was a lot of politics involved. The ag sector was very loud in terms of, you know, we don't want our farmers regulated in terms of what's coming off their fields.
Sure.
Also,
isn't it just a lot more, it's a lot simpler, it seems like, to regulate what's coming out of the end of a pipe than it is for what's coming from, what, a couple million acres of watershed?
Yeah, it's very difficult to monitor just exactly what's happening in a runoff situation, especially in a large, unconfined, rural kind of setting. Urban areas are a little bit easier to monitor because a lot of that stuff is going into a storm drain and then coming out.
It's coming out of pipe.
A little bit of a pipe.
Sure.
So you can monitor it a little bit better. But yeah, in general, the kind of more diffuse sheet and rill erosion, as we call it out in the country, from fields and such, is very difficult to monitor. You can put edge of field monitors on some fields. You can kind of siphon the water that's running off a field through an edge of field monitor, and some of that is done. The U.S. Geological Survey helps with some of that around the state. So you can monitor a farm field and see just exactly what's happening, and there's a lot of good research out there showing that when farming practices are changed and geared toward controlling that runoff, it does actually work. It does actually show in those edge of field monitors that less water is flowing off the field, mm-hmm. and the water that is leaving the field is of better quality.
So for the folks keeping score at home, I'm going to give you some, I want to kind of keep up with like a legend or a key here, because there's a lot of jargony terms that get thrown around when we talk about surface water quality and good Lord, any kind of Clean Water Act stuff. So, TMDL, basically a massive study that measures where pollutants are coming from, whether it be, you know, from point source or non-point source. Point source, things coming from the end of a pipe. Non-point, things that wash into the watershed. And 303D, Clean Water Act stuff. So anyway, I'm...
A lot of stuff.
Oh, there's so much, and it's so complicated, and with wetlands and with everything, it really is. You mentioned water quality standards, like if these lakes, and there were some new additions from Western Wisconsin on this list.
Quite a few.
A lot in Barron County, I noticed.
Clark County has quite a few, too.
Sure. So what kind of standards are these are not being upheld, I guess, or what is the problem? What are the issues that make these things go on the list?
Well, principally in this part of the state, most of the impaired waters are listed for nutrients, pretty much nitrogen and phosphorus and sediment, sediment load.
And a lot of people probably know why that would be a problem, but in a nutshell, what could be a problem related to nutrient load?
Well, the way I like to explain this when I'm talking to folks is when you fertilize your lawn, what you're putting on your lawn is nitrogen and phosphorus because that helps the plants grow, and we need that too. We eat plants and animals that have nitrogen and phosphorus in it. All living things need that stuff to survive. And so when we fertilize our lawn, we're putting that stuff on it to make the plants grow more. They like it. It's like the all-you-can-eat buffet for the plants. You give them lots of nitrogen and phosphorus, and they'll go to town. Algae, which are the green little plant cells that cause our lakes and rivers to turn green, algae are plants. They're little floating plant cells in the streams and rivers and lakes. And algae needs to be there. It's the base of the food chain. Much as on a prairie ecosystem, grass is the base of the food chain. In a lake, algae is the base of the food chain. The tiny little critters that swim around in the rivers and lakes are eating the algae, and the bigger critters are eating the smaller critters and on up the food chain. So we need that algae there in a certain quantity. But when you put too much nitrogen and phosphorus, or I guess put is the wrong word, when too much nitrogen and phosphorus find their way into our lakes and rivers from runoff, from manure, from fertilizer, from soil, because nitrogen and phosphorus is in soil. So if soil gets in there, that will also dissolve into the water body. When that stuff gets in there, it's the all-you-can-eat buffet for the algae. And they go to town and you get an algae bloom. And algae blooms are problematic for many reasons. They can cause, especially when you get blue-green algae or cyanobacteria, those things produce toxins that are dangerous to animal life, to humans as well. Just about every year, somewhere in Wisconsin, we hear that a dog drank out of a lake and died. Mm. And what happens is the toxins from the blue-green algae, they can affect your liver, can cause liver issues, they can affect your skin, and there are some of them that are neurotoxins. They basically shut down your central nervous system and cause, that's what the dogs usually will die of, they'll stop breathing, they get paralyzed. So blue-green algae is a very bad issue. But even if blue-green algae isn't present, if you have a large algae bloom, what happens then is we call this process, here's another generic or another jargon term for you, eutrophication. When a lake gets too nutrified, you get a huge algae bloom. The algae eat all of the nutrients there. And then when the nutrients begin to run out, the algae die. And what happens is the decomposing bacteria that eat the algae use up all the oxygen in the water. Mm. So then you get fish kills. There's not enough oxygen in the water for the fish because the bacteria that are decomposing the algae are using up all of the oxygen.
So we hear about this dead zone at the end of the Mississippi River once it dumps into the Gulf of Mexico. Is that kind of the same thing?
Yeah, it's freshwater systems and saltwater systems work a little bit differently. Yeah. In our freshwater systems, phosphorus is usually the limiting factor. Nitrates are usually present in pretty good quantities and increasing quantities the way things are going
now.
And
we'll get to that a little bit.
But yeah, nitrates are usually present in surface water. Phosphorus, because nitrates move pretty easily from different forms and through different systems and through the soil. Phosphorus is a little bit more of a, it has to be kind of dissolved and find its way into streams and lakes, usually through runoff. It doesn't seep through groundwater. It doesn't seep out of the sediments in the streams very easily. But once you get down to a saltwater system, once you get down to the Gulf of Mexico, it kind of reverses. Then nitrogen becomes a little bit more of the limiting factor. Mm-hmm. But it's still the same thing. It's still the nutrients that end up in the Gulf of Mexico, nitrates and phosphorus. those nutrients basically cause the same thing. They cause
a feeding frenzy that sucks up all the oxygen.
Yeah, they call it a dead zone because, and depending on the season and the year, sometimes you know that area at the mouth of the Mississippi is anywhere from you know the size of New Jersey up to the size of Massachusetts, and it can be pretty bad. But there's nothing. Can hang out there because there's just not enough oxygen in the water, and that affects the fisheries down there and the tourism and everything else. So, yeah, we send our problems downstream. We have them here, but we send them downstream too.
And that's like the oldest story in the book when it comes to you know, the way we... It used to be, what, dilution is the solution to pollution, the mm-hmm. mantra for wastewater treatment. Anyhow, we're going to take a quick break here on the west side. We're talking about water quality in western Wisconsin, northwestern Wisconsin, west central Wisconsin. Going to touch as many bases as we can here. We're talking with Dan Zur. He's a natural resources educator for UW Extension. We've also got Kevin Masaryk in the studio. He's a groundwater education specialist at UW Stevens Point with the Center for Watershed Science and Education. He's going to tell us a little bit about some groundwater results from Chippewa County and elsewhere. 1-800-228-5615 is the number to call if you've got questions or comments. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more specifically about newly impaired waters or new waters that are added to the list of the Department of Natural Resources impaired waters, and a lot of them in western Wisconsin. So 1-800-228-5615 if you've got a question or a comment for Dan Zur or Kevin Masaryk. We'll be back with more West Side in just a bit.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Wollersheim Winery and Distillery, producing wine and spirits from Wisconsin-grown grapes and grains. Information on tours and tastings and more is at wollersheim.com. Support also comes from the River Falls Chamber of Commerce, presenting the River Falls Roots and Bluegrass Music Festival, 40-plus hours of bluegrass, beer and wine tasting, and more, April 13th through the 15th, riverfallsbluegrass.com.
You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on Ideas 88.3 WHWC, Menominee Eau Claire, and 88.7 WRFW. I'm Rich Kramer, joined by two water experts from western and west central Wisconsin. Kevin Masaryk is a groundwater education specialist at UW Stevens Point. Dan Zur is a natural resources educator for UW Extension. Currently, we're talking about the state a list of state impaired waters that was published by the DNR this year, and that number has grown. And some of the waters that are listed as impaired come from western Wisconsin. If you've got a question about that or about groundwater or whatever related to water quality in your area, give us a call at 1-800-228-5615. Also curious to think what our listeners' opinions are as in terms of how the state is managing its water resources. 1-800-228-5615. So, Dan Zur, just before the break, we were talking a little bit about this list of impaired waters. So, 45 new additions to that. I just kind of glanced. I did an alphabetical search. I was in a big hurry, so I saw Barron County, but you also mentioned Clark County. So in a nutshell, where are we seeing these new additions to the list? And also, is it surprising or not?
Well, they're really all over the place. There's Eau Claire County and Barron County and Chippewa County especially have quite a few that have been added. And sometimes it's just another segment of a stream, because when they assess rivers, they assess them in segments. And it might be that just the segment that's closest to the mouth of the river, when you're getting down toward wherever that river empties, it might be that just that segment had been listed before, and now they're going farther upstream, and some more little segments of that stream have been added. So that happens often. But a couple that jump out in my mind is, you know, we have the wonderful jewel that is the Beaver Creek Reserve in this area. And Beaver Creek is now on the 303D list.
Really?
That one, and also the North Fork of the Eau Claire River. The Eau Claire River has a South Fork and North Fork that come together just on the east side of Lake Eau Claire. And the North Fork of the Eau Claire River is now proposed to be added to the 303D list.
And in those situations, are we talking about excess nutrients like phosphorus?
We're talking about phosphorus and sediment for the most part, okay. Yeah. And I don't have the list in front of me, so I know that the Eau Claire system, one of the problems with the Eau Claire system is there's a lot of sand out in that system, a very, very sandy soil, and we're getting a lot of erosion because that sand erodes so easily and the banks erode so easily. So there's a lot of excess sediment entering the Eau Claire system because of the sandy soils in that area. And you'd think, well, you know, wouldn't that have been the case historically? But what you see is as we increase the amount of runoff coming from farm fields, as we see climate change causing these larger deluge rainfalls that we, you know, we're getting 100 and 500 year floods now every couple of years, that causes these streams to get very flashy. In other words, they rise very quickly, and that can cause bank erosion in ways that we haven't seen in years past. So the whole, I guess, before I ramble on too much, I'll get to the message that what we want to do, what we're trying to do, and what we want everybody, whether you're a farmer or whether you have a land in an urban area or whatever it happens to be, find ways to get rainfall to infiltrate where it falls. Keep it from flowing across the land. So that's the goal. If we can get more infiltration of the rainfall that's coming, and especially now in these larger rainfall events, we have to pay more attention to that because we've seen farmers talking about forested hillsides eroding that have been in place for, you know, as many generations as they've owned their farm. They're looking at these forested hillsides near their farm, and those forested hillsides are eroding, and that's not something
that's not supposed to happen.
Yeah, that's not something we've seen in a lot of these areas. So climate change is definitely causing some issues make us a little bit more conscious of this kind of stuff. But any way that you can, if you're a farmer or if you're an urban landowner, figure out ways to make that water infiltrate where it falls. Less in an urban environment, that means like less concrete, less impermeable surfaces, capture the water with a rain garden in your yard, whatever it happens to be. And on the farm, there's a lot of education going on about that in terms of soil health practices, cover crops, keeping something on the land year round that will help keep the rainfall from eroding that land. No-till farming practices, which means you're not tilling the soil over. Every time you till the soil over, you're killing a lot of the organic critters, a lot of the living critters in the soil, and decreasing the soil organic matter. If we want that soil to soak up more water, we need to increase the organic content of the soil, and no-till helps with that greatly. And basically trying to mimic nature more as best we can. If you look at a prairie ecosystem, for instance, you know, those prairie plants have huge root systems.
Right.
The root system for your lawn is about 2 inches long, you know, and so if we can get some larger root systems in people's yards, whether in a rain garden or some kind of little prairie plot for people that live in more rural areas, that kind of stuff is going to help infiltration. And on the farm, of course, the no-till practices and soil health and nutrient management, getting farmers to manage the manure that they spread and the fertilizers that they apply in a way that keeps an eye on just how much do you really need? How much do you really need to put on the land, and when?
Right.
Applying it to frozen ground is a bad thing because if it rains or the snow melts on frozen ground, that's all just going to flow off right into a ditch or into a creek. So those are some of the things that we want people to do.
We will get to unpack that a little bit in just a little while here, but I wanted to go to Kevin Masaryk and talk a little bit about groundwater. So specifically, I was looking at some work that you're doing in Chippewa County to test some groundwater wells. But in a nutshell, in our region in western Wisconsin and west central Wisconsin, what is the verdict overall on groundwater? Are we in a good place or not a good place? If I can simplify it to an absurd level, Kevin Masaryk.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the one thing that I try to get across to people is that groundwater really is a local resource. So there's a lot of misconceptions that people have about their groundwater. You know, why is groundwater important? Because we all rely on water to live, to run our businesses, to operate our farms. And oftentimes we're using wells to access that resource. Unless you live along the Great Lakes in Wisconsin, everybody else for the most part is relying on groundwater as their primary water supply. Mm. And if we look at the individual water quality or well water quality of people's property, that water quality really is kind of dictated by what happens on the landscape nearby, you know, maybe a half to a couple miles away.
Okay.
It's not, you know, we're not getting water from Canada or Lake Superior here. Really, the water that we're using, that we're pulling out of the ground from our wells, is water that recharged locally and is probably years to maybe decades old.
Hmm.
So whatever we do on the landscape is what's responsible for our individual well water quality. And that's an interesting concept to people sometimes, because it really is, when you ask the question or pose the question, what's the verdict on groundwater quality? And I would say it really depends on where you live.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Chippewa County, we're just in the process of completing a study that allowed us to test 800 wells around Chippewa County in the summer of 2016. And what we found is that people's individual well water quality really depended on where they were located within the county. Some places the water quality was quite good. Other areas, the water quality might have been impacted by certain land use activities that would have impacted things like nitrate or maybe chloride levels, which result from some of the same things that Dan was talking about before relating to surface water nutrient impacts.
So chloride, I mean, is that... I've been reading some stories recently, and it almost seems like we're surprised that chloride from things like road salt could hurt groundwater quality, when I guess if you're just driving, you realize the amount of salt and what it does to our vehicles, well, that doesn't just disappear. So, but you mentioned nitrates as well, so I wanted to kind of touch on what you mentioned, the 10-year recharge thing. So what's happening on the surface right now will impact that water that they're drinking for 10 years, maybe more.
Correct. So where Dan was talking a lot about TMDLs and surface waters, and those impaired waters, a lot of times phosphorus and sediment are the main issues. Those are things that get to those water bodies relatively quickly.
And they move on through.
Because they're resulting from runoff. So when rain falls or snow melts faster than it can infiltrate into the soil, it tends to run off. Wisconsin gets about, on average, 32 inches of rain each year. We would expect about 20 inches of that rain and snow to evaporate or be taken up by plants. That leaves about 12 inches to either run off or soak down into the ground.
Hmm.
On average, maybe only 1 to 2 inches is what we expect to run off. That means 10 inches, the majority of what's not evaporated, soaks down into the ground and becomes groundwater. And as it's doing that, it's going to dissolve things like chloride from the roads. It's going to dissolve some of the nitrogen as nitrate and push it down or leach it into groundwater, where it becomes problematic, not only for people who have private wells that might be using that water for drinking and cooking. But here in Wisconsin, our surface waters are intimately connected to our groundwater. It's really groundwater that supplies the majority of water to our rivers, streams, and lakes. So we can't, oftentimes we talk about them as separate resources, but we have to realize that what impacts groundwater will ultimately impact surface waters. But there's a pretty sizable delay or lag time between when that water infiltrates and when it's going to reemerge at either somebody's well,
mm-hmm.
or reemerge at a spring or a creek or a stream or a lake. But these things are all connected. That's why we call it the water cycle. It's because the water really is just cycling through the landscape, cycling through the atmosphere, and then that whole cycle is repeated.
And I'll say that as someone who moved from far northern Wisconsin, where there's not nearly the amount of agricultural activity as there is down here, it was really interesting to notice the differences in terms of water quality at, say, swimming beaches, for example, and even just the idea that you got to be wary, more wary down in this part of the state, and probably even more wary when you get into the karst geology down in the Green Bay, Kewaunee area than you do up in the forests of the north. So that just is an aside. I'm going to go to the phones right now. We've got Terry in Colfax waiting to get a comment on the air. Terry, are you there?
I'm pretty good, and I thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure. What's on your mind, sir?
I've been the town of Colfax Plan Commission chair since 2003, and we built our comprehensive plan pretty much around water. I think we have a treasurer up here and a retired hydrologist named Neil Koch, and he states that there's 115 places within Dunn County that they dump human septic on the ground. He even had the county make a recharge map, a water recharge map. But I go to the DNR, and maybe I'm missing something, but I don't. They seem to have a map for everything, but they don't seem to have a map for where we're still dumping septic on the ground. Is he right? Is he wrong?
Terry, we'll go to the experts here, because I have no idea. I've not heard of that. Thank you so much for the call, though. I'm looking at Dan Zur on this one. Is that a practice that is allowed?
Oh, yeah, it's not. I don't have the specifics of how much and where, but oftentimes the product of wastewater treatment, whether that's human wastewater treatment or the wastewater treatment of large CAFOs, large confined animal feeding operations, that is spread on land and used as a fertilizer because it is very high in nitrogen and phosphorus. Whether or not that's being done in quantities that it shouldn't be, or if the data is not available, I can't say. I don't really know the details of that, but that's what is done oftentimes with the products of our wastewater treatment, is it's used as a fertilizer.
But we're not talking about raw, straight out of the honey well kind of a thing.
Well, if we're talking about septic systems, I wouldn't call it raw. It's not as treated as something coming out of an urban wastewater treatment plant, but the products coming out of a septic system, and Kevin can probably talk more about this than I can, are not raw sewage, but they have probably a little bit more problematic qualities than does something that's been treated by a wastewater treatment plant.
Kevin Masaryk, want to jump in?
Yeah, so as Dan stated, you know, you have wastewater treatment plants that if you live in a city, your waste is sent there. There's a variety of different treatment systems or ways in which that waste is treated to deactivate pathogens and try and remove some of the nutrients. Whereas if you live out in the country, you have a septic system, you have your own kind of private on-site wastewater treatment system.
Like a leach field?
It's a septic tank, which traps a lot of the solids, but allows the liquid portion to go to a drain field where it leaches out. And the drain fields are designed to remove bacteria and help with pathogens, okay, to try to deactivate those things. They don't, you know, remove all the waste. We know that things like nitrate and chloride, you know, are going to eventually leach down into the groundwater from those drain fields. But there's that solid product that is held in that septic tank. And that's the reason why every 3 years the county should be sending you a notice that you need to pump your septic tank. Or people that have holding tanks, you know, holding tanks.
For manure.
Holding tanks would be people that live out in the rural area that, for one reason or another, can't have a drain field. Mm. They have holding tanks, which mean that, you know, all the water in their home gets sent to this holding tank. And that needs to be pumped much more often than somebody with an actual drain field, because the drain field allows you to get rid of a lot of that liquid. But bringing it back to the question, you know, these things, these septic tanks or these holding tanks are pumped into some sort of, you know, truck where they would add something like lime to try to, you know, raise the pH and try to, you know, help control some of the pathogen activity. But a lot of times, you know, it might be common for that to be spread on an approved field. We hope that they would do it at rates which is in accordance with what the soil is able to hold on to and absorb, and in accordance with a nutrient management plan. It is more and more common for, hopefully, for some of that septage to actually be transported to a wastewater treatment plant, mm-hmm. where it would be treated similar to how people in cities are having their waste treated. But to the caller's point, there are places where septic tanks are pumped. There's minimal treatment or reagents applied to try and deactivate some of the pathogens. But it does get spread on the landscape in certain places. The soils that are allowed to receive that waste do have criteria which dictate which fields are appropriate and which fields aren't.
So do either of you gentlemen have an idea of where Terry might be able to go, or other people might be able to go, to find out how much or where this stuff is being spread via the DNR?
It sounds like Terry probably is about as well versed as anybody in terms of where to mm-hmm. where to go. I know there are people in other counties that have been frustrated at the ability to access that information. Sometimes I think they a lot of the maps that are available are the approved sites. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily give a good idea of which sites are actively receiving waste in any given time or year, and that's, I think, a challenge with where we're at today is the rate at which these things are being put on fields is difficult to track, and we haven't probably applied technology as effectively as we could to understand where all this waste is being spread. I think that's definitely an area where the state could improve upon.
With that, let's take our final break here. We do have another call that we'll take right after the we get returned with more discussion about groundwater and surface water quality. Water quality, it's all connected. It's more than important for us. And we're speaking with two experts on the subject today. Dan Zurr is a natural resources educator for UW Extension based out of Eau Claire, and Kevin Masaryk is a groundwater education specialist at UW Stevens Point. 1-800-228-5615. Christina and Glenwood, hang tight. We're going to get right back to you in just a bit. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about that Chippewa County well study that Kevin has already alluded to. 1-800-228-5615.
I'm Lucy Ramshaw, and I'm from Mount Horeb, Wisconsin. I just like the radio station. I just pure out and out think it's the best of the best to listen to. When we traveled, I always kept poking the button till I found a public radio station to listen to. It's just in my DNA to listen to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Include us in your estate plan. Visit WPRLegacy.org.
Support for WPR comes from the John Michael Kohler Art Center in Sheboygan, presenting Unseen Forces, 5 original exhibitions exploring invisible powers at play in the world and in contemporary art. JMKAC.org. Support also comes from the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center, presenting an evening with acoustic pianist George Winston, 7:30, Sunday, April 22nd, at the State Theater. Tickets are available at eauclairearts.com.
I'm Rich Kramer. You're listening to The West Side. We're talking about water quality in western Wisconsin with two experts on the subject. Dan Zurr is a natural resources educator for UW Extension, and Kevin Masaryk is a groundwater education specialist at UW Stevens Point, credited as the source for your groundwater questions. 1-800-228-5615 is the number to call. We're talking now about groundwater and terms of, say, nitrates and other things, and there's a study that is ongoing in Chippewa County, but I first heard about it in 2016, studied 800 wells to measure for things like nitrates and other organic materials or other things that can cause problems for humans. So very interesting stuff, and the final report is still to come, but we're getting a bit of a sneak peek. Before we get back into that, though, we're going to go to Christina in Glenwood City. Christina, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi there. Thank you. I have two questions. So I have a well. how often should I get the water tested, and what should I test for, such as copper or metals or anything like that? And then I have another question following this.
Okay, let's do that one first. Kevin.
Sure. So there is some general guidance for people that have private wells in terms of what they should be testing for and the frequency. Anytime a new well is installed in Wisconsin, it is required to be tested generally just for bacteria. As of 2014, it's also required to be tested for nitrate at that time. So that's not a lot of required tests. And one time probably isn't enough even for those elements. We would recommend everyone probably test, you know, annually or almost annually for things like bacteria and nitrate. And then there's a whole host of other things that if you've never tested for them would be good to know. Things like arsenic, things like lead or copper, if those materials are in your plumbing system. If your nitrate level is elevated or you live near kind of agricultural fields where pesticides might be more likely, that might also be something that would be important to test for. Other things, if you live near a landfill, you know, within a quarter mile of a landfill or within a quarter mile of maybe an old dry cleaner or an old gasoline station, there might be a need to test for things called volatile organic compounds. So what you test for really sometimes depends on, again, where you live and what's on the landscape around you. But in general, most people would benefit from kind of an annual or a regular bacteria and a nitrate test. And
so I don't mean to interrupt, but I would imagine the rural homeowners will laugh at me for this. But well testing, can it be – I mean, is it – will the county provide free testing, or is this something that if you want to test more and more things, it gets more and more expensive?
Great question. And I try to get the point across to people that if you have a well, you really are your own water utility manager. You're the one that's responsible for deciding what to test for, the frequency. And even though some counties will sometimes have programs where they offer to pay for the testing, in general, that's the homeowner responsibility.
Okay.
There's testing. You can test any time of the year. There's a variety of public health laboratories that do testing as well as private laboratories. I know Eau Claire County Health Department has a testing lab. I know there's a private lab out of Colfax that a lot of people use. So there's many opportunities, and I don't want the unknown of where and how to send a sample to prevent people from testing, because there's a lot of people that would be willing to help with that.
Christina, you had another follow-up?
Yes, I do. Thank you. The Emerald Dairy, which has about 3,000 cows near Glenwood City, they had a big manure spill. And I'm wondering, are you aware of any impact that it may have had on the groundwater or local wells?
I'm not familiar with that particular event. Anytime manure or materials like that are spilled on the landscape, you know, we do have to be concerned. There's some areas that are even more vulnerable than others in terms of what those impacts might be. And with something like manure, the main concern would obviously be pathogens. And if you're in an area where the soil is thin or maybe absent, and that the rock in that area is fractured or karstic, those are areas that we'd be more concerned about things like bacteria getting down into the groundwater and potentially people's wells. Other things associated with manure would be things like nitrate. That's obviously one of the reasons why we like to apply it to fields, is because it contains those nutrients. But too much, whether it's from a spill or just too much from over-application, can release some of that nitrate down into the groundwater. So those would be the two main concerns associated with something like a manure spill from a groundwater standpoint. And there's also the concern from a runoff standpoint of that spill reaching a surface water as well.
And I'm certainly not trying to alarm anybody, but there's some health concerns with regards to nitrate intake.
So nitrate, there's a drinking water standard of 10 milligrams per liter, and that standard is primarily set for infants less than 6 months of age.
Okay.
Because of concerns regarding methemoglobinemia. The common name for that is blue baby disease.
Mm.
So it's a condition that can be fatal if left untreated. There's also concern with regards to women who are pregnant or trying to become pregnant, in that really high or elevated nitrate might cause birth defects or even miscarriages in that population. So there are some things to consider with regards to nitrate.
Christina, thanks so much for the calls. We appreciate the call. 1-800-228-5615. We probably have enough time to take one or two more. If you've got questions for either Kevin Masaryk or Dan Zur, we're talking about water quality in western Wisconsin. There are incidences of more reports of nitrate levels in private wells happening. Specifically, it tends to seem like it's around agricultural areas. Also, the surface waters, we've known for a long time that excess nutrient runoff leads to some unsightly and potentially dangerous situations in impoundments, lakes like Lake Tainter and Lake Menomon near Menominee. They are well-versed in that situation. 1-800-228-5615. I wanted to talk, Kevin Masaryk, quickly again about the 800 wells that were surveyed and tested. So in a nutshell, what did you find? Did anything jump out at you? Because what I don't know, I don't live this stuff. The nitrate levels seemed interesting to me. I was just wondering, what was your takeaway on that just before the results are coming out?
So where Chippewa County is unique is that they've done this testing of 800 wells, or roughly 800 wells, in 1985, 2006, and again in 2016.
Wow.
So it gives that county the ability to kind of compare water quality over time. And the average kind of nitrate concentration it did increase a little bit from 2006 to 2016. It increased on average by maybe a milligram per liter or so, which doesn't sound like a lot. But probably the more concerning thing is that the percentage of wells that were over the 10 milligram per liter standard went from about 13% in 2007 up to 19% in 2016. Hmm. So even though they're not increasing by a lot, that increase does mean that there's, as a percentage, more wells considered to be unsuitable from a drinking water standpoint than there have been previously.
And what's interesting, Chippewa County, if you live there, the county has a link on its land and water conservation website that gives a little bit of a PDF, kind of a basic rundown of what you're looking for there. And the map is interesting, the maps that accompany, especially with regards to nitrates, that it's just interesting to see the clusters. And I noticed there's a lot of clusters near Lake Wissota. And I would think that might be because it's collecting are we sure?
Again, an individual well is we can probably look at what happens within a half mile or so of that well to understand what the impact or where that impact is coming from.
Sure.
So we know that there's generally a correlation or relationship between agricultural activity. Also, septic system drain field density would impact where we find nitrate in Chippewa County.
I see. Okay, we've got a lot of calls coming in. Unfortunately, we're not going to get to all of them. But first, we're going to go to, I believe it's Ricky. Have I got that right?
Yes.
What's on your mind?
I'm in Russ County, and I have 1 acre of land, and I'm surrounded by a beef cattle herd.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's lots of runoff and poop and stuff. If I had my well tested and it's bad, what recourse would I have? Would I have any recourse with the farmer, to deal with this? How could I deal with that?
Well, that's a great question. Kevin Masaryk.
So the first thing I'd recommend is first test, because a lot of times people have concerns that after they test, they realize that their water quality is just fine. So I'd first recommend testing for bacteria and doing a nitrate test and see what those show first.
Okay, because I looked on the web, they're so expensive, those tests, but bacteria and nitrate you would recommend, okay?
Yeah, and bacteria and nitrate, just to put it into perspective, you're probably talking around $50 for both of those tests It'll obviously be dependent on the individual laboratory, but that's kind of a ballpark figure for what those two tests generally cost.
If this poop is all draining down into my swamp that then gets into my groundwater and stuff.
Yep, and we look at the soils in an area. We hope that in areas with sufficient soil that's going to act as kind of a filter to hopefully protect the water below. That doesn't always happen, though, and that's really why testing is really important for understanding your water quality.
Ricky, thank you so much for the call, and we do have one more caller on the line. I'm not going to be able to get to them. My apologies, but with the time remaining, which is brief, what do we do about this? I mean, we've got these regulations, whether it be through the Clean Water Act, there's state regulations. A lot of people have been frustrated with how the Department of Natural Resources has handled this. A lot of blame going around towards farmers, a lot of fingers, like a hand with maybe a dozen fingers pointing in different directions. So I need you, Dan Zur, to solve it. And so anyway, what can the average person do to try to remedy this, or what should, if they're concerned about it, what should they do?
Well, in terms of blame, you can pretty much get the same amount of nutrients from an acre of urban land as you can from an acre of rural land. The issue in this part of the state is most of the watersheds are rural, and there's a lot of agricultural land, so that's where the biggest effect is coming from, just because of the acreage. So as I mentioned before, farmers doing things focused on soil health, no-till tilling practices, and cover crops. If you live in an urban area, find ways on your property, rather than completely paving your driveway, put paving stones in there that have cracks between the stones where the water can infiltrate, so all the water coming off your property isn't running down into the sewer. Any way that we can find to infiltrate water on our land is what we want to do.
Kevin Masaryk, if people are concerned about groundwater or their wells, et cetera, what can they do, either to attest or remedy?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a lot of the same things Dan talked about. We should all try to be good neighbors. Look at what we're doing on our properties, whether it's fertilizing our lawns or fertilizing our agricultural fields, and figure out how we can do better.
With that, gentlemen, thank you so much for your discussion this hour. Kevin Masaryk is a groundwater education specialist at UW-Stevens Point. Dan Zur is a natural resources educator with UW-Extension. Thank you very much. Also, big thanks are due to Team Westside, including Mort Cypress, Bonnie Lenz Clark, Henry Lippold, Hannah Pritzel, of course, Dean the Dartball Kid Kallenbach, and Kate Spranger for helping keep the whole thing on the rails. Next week, we'll do a checkup on the growing number of solar energy projects in western Wisconsin. Until then, have a safe and productive week. We'll chat again next Monday morning.